Blog Talk Radio.
Come on, baby, make it hot. Ride the cock till you hit the spot. Come on, baby, make it hot.
Doing the doggy style. Wow, 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 yippee yo, yippee yay, bow wow, yippee yo, yippee. Wow, 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 yippee yo, yippee yay, bow wow, yippee yo, yippee.
And welcome. We have arrived in the clouds again.
Yep, here we are.
Yeah, another Wednesday night here on Naked Summer, and we have a special treat to start the shoe. As my baseball team has done it again in the off season, as they want to do. So I will celebrate thusly. If this maricon tube will work.
Bring your kids, bring your wife. Guaranteed to have the time of your life. Because the Mets are really sucking the ball. Knocking those home runs over the wall. Inside, where the side. Everybody coming down. To meet the M-E-T-S Mets.
Oh, the butcher and the baker and the people on the street. Where do they go? To meet the Mets! Oh, they run them in the hues and they put them in the street. Where do they go?
To meet the Mets! All the fans are true to the orange and blue.
Hurry up and come on down. Cause we got Johan Santana, Mets of New York Town. Give him a yell!
Give him a hand! And let him know you're rooting in the back.
Mi amigos!
Meet the Mets! Meet the Mets! Step right up and greet the Mets! Bring your kiddies, bring your wife. Guaranteed to have the time of your life. Because the Mets are really knocking the ball. Knocking those home runs over the wall. Inside, where everybody comes down.
All the illegal aliens in the boogie down.
T.S. Mets of New York Town. Of New York.
Were you dancing?
Doing a whole eco-funkophilia repertoire.
I knew it. I could feel it from here.
Sure to see me do it when I heard the news yesterday.
Oh, I can imagine. Hey, guess who's with us already?
Joining us from Loserville up there in New Hampshire, who lost the Johan sweepstakes, who they really were pretending because they didn't want the crankies to get them, is Dr. Jeb.
Hey.
How did the Red Sox Nation absorb this stunning defeat?
It was not a defeat at all. I don't want to say we didn't want him, but
he's got
nobody
him in the American
fan
League, though. Yeah.
Oh, we didn't want him in the American League. Nobody in the fan base that I talked to wanted to give up what two they wanted to give to get him.
Right. It was basically just to get the Yankees to up the ante, so they got squeamish, and then the Mets swooped in. This guy's going to make $1 million start.
Theo Epstein and Brian Cashman have done. They're good buddies, and they. What's his name? Epstein was just up there at a talk that Cashman was sponsoring, and people were asking about it. And when they asked Cashman, he said, "No, it's not in our plans, or at least it's not in my plans. I don't want to give up what they are asking." And Epstein was like, "Yep," nodding his head, "Yes." And so the feeling amongst those who were watching was that the handshake deal, a backdoor handshake deal between Cashman and Epstein, but that neither of them wanted to make the deal. That if they could get him for, what they were putting out there, that would be fine. But I don't know, it seemed like they were both wanting to keep going in the direction they were going with the young players. And I'm psyched for the Mets. I think the Mets needed that more than the Yankees or the Red Sox, because they needed that splash and that boost. And
done nothing all winter. I mean, the fans were jumping off the bridge over there. They basically hadn't pursued any free agents, or they were going to go to town with basically no bullpen and a broken down Pedro, and
It was like, I heard a Mets Hot Stove thing last Saturday, and Beltran's like, we will have to win every game 7-6, you know. And
that was good.
Yeah, my Beltran's voice is going, he's hilarious. Excellent center field. We're going to have a Red Sox Nation representative joining us here in a couple of minutes to talk about his movie, The Joy of Sox. So this is apropos to get a real pulse of what the Red Sox Nation is feeling, because I really think it was a Tinkers to Evers to Chance sort of. No one told Hank Steinbrenner that was going on, though. He was in and out of that thing like, boy, it was the hokey pokey. Even up until Monday, they were dangling Philip Hughes at the Twinkies, and for some reason, the Twins kept saying, no, we don't want Melky Cabrera. We want those minor league prospects that the Mets have. Because think about Minnesota. They've traded away, their iconic pitcher now with Johan. And they just gave up,
Torrey Hunter.
Well, Torrey Hunter, he left for California. I'm talking basketball. They tore apart their basketball team, and gave up, to the Celtics.
Kevin Garnett. Is that
Kevin Garnett, who was the franchise for the Timberwolves?
Yeah.
And this is almost like 20 years to the day or 18 years to the day that the Mets got Viola from the Twins for all those prospects.
Right.
He was a young Cy Young Award winner. I was in Iowa when that happened, and it was the night of the trading deadline, and Frank Viola was an old Long Island sape, and so I'm out there in the middle of nowhere screaming and yelling, "We're gonna get the Sausage King!" That was a big thing. The Viola family sold sausages on Long Island, so it was a big deal. I used to see the trucks go by, Viola sausages. So every time he pitched, if he got 10 strikeouts, he got like a free sausage or something. Like, it was very funny. But anyway, long story short, we get this guy, and it was like, this is before internet, so it was headline CNN headline news. It came like every like half hour that this stinking thing would come on. So I get up at like 5 in the morning, and it's like, the deal was cut, and you see a clip of Viola pitching for the Twins, and it's like, the things scrolling across the bottom of the screen. So imagine yourself running around in the streets of Davenport, Iowa, screaming, we got the Sausage King. It was an attractive, which actually, to circumvent and circleize, I had the same experience when the Giants won the Super Bowl early stages of 1991, right before I graduated from chiropractic college and made my way back east. Again, the only guy in Davenport, Iowa, when the field goal went wide left, wide right, sorry, was wide left, wide to my left on the screen, wide to the kicker's right. Another one of those weird moments of, yelling at the wilderness and nobody cared. The farmers went, what the hell's that?
Was that Scott Bill Buckner Norwood,
who kicked
that one right?
Yeah, that's another one. That's another one of those. Maybe we get into that with the guest tonight. When someone screws up, like Beltran, Game 7 against the Cardinals a couple of years ago, the dynamic that went on between that whole at bat, and this is something that maybe we can get into with this. We're going to talk about fan energy and crowd coherence tonight, which is going to be a factor definitely this weekend with the Super Bowl. So, is he here? No, not yet. Oh, he is. Is that him? No. Okay.
No.
We're not ready for the guest yet. No.
So, hey, you know what, Val?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
If I pop out, then I'll call right back. We need like a code, like Tippy Toe or Lemon Tree or something, so I can so I can be on mute. Can you mute me, or can?
Yeah, I can.
Like, I got babies and kids and stuff. So
I'd
like to be in on the interview. So I don't know what to do. I don't know how to send the chicken wing signal or something. So I can.
All right. You know what? Can you sign on to your Gmail and then message me?
I'm carrying.
Or?
I'm walking. Carrying
a baby.
Get
it.
Right now.
All right. Let me think. Mm.
What? I'll just call back. So if you see me blink off and come back,
you know what you could do.
The code word could be Mookie, and then we know to mute you.
Well, you could.
Well, that's true.
Just say
that's
Mookie.
True, because you could just, I'll just say,
Mookie.
How about Yo-Yo Ma?
Either that or you could buzz my cell phone.
Yeah.
Yo-Yo Ma.
All right, well, on cue, joining us now from high atop Red Sox Nation, if I can get him unmuted. You have any luck over there, Val?
I can't. No, you did
it. Wait.
Can you hear me?
There he is. Okay.
Yay.
Got it?
Got it.
Director Rick Leskowitz from what part of you of the Boston area are you from up there?
I'm from a suburb named Needham, called Needham.
Needham, okay. I've been lost in basically every aspect of Boston you could be lost in, you know, I'm like that guy on the train you guys have up there.
That's easy to do, Charlie and the MTA, right?
That's right. So we just were celebrating the Johan Santana trade here a minute ago, because I'm a Met fan. We have Dr. Jeb Thurman is one of our co-hosts. He lives up in New Hampshire, and we were getting sort of a tangential read on Red Sox Nation, how they sort of bowed and courteously to the Mets because, of course, you know, Johan leaves the American League, and the Yankees didn't get him.
That's correct. That's the bottom line.
One of those antithetical things of sports fandom. It's like there's a certain amount of what's that German word I always lose in my head when you celebrate the misery of others. There you go.
Yeah.
A lot of Schadenfreude up in the Red Sox Nation.
Well, I'm actually glad we didn't get Santana, because it would have been another multi-million-dollar deal, and it would mean that we could throw around money just like the Yankees, and there was nothing magical about our team anymore. It was just a matter of big bucks. So I think we can do it the scrappy way.
You know, maybe you can shed some light on this, because you've been around for the whole ride. You've been a Red Sox fan your whole life, I'm assuming, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. So take me back to 86 for a minute, because we were just discussing Buckner here a minute ago as we were talking about the missed field goal in the Super Bowl with the Bills and other public failures like that.
Right.
So you're a Red Sox fan. You're watching this game. You're one strike away from the World Series. I think they had nine chances to close that game out with strike two in that inning. And I'm a Met fan. I'm in college in Albany.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm in a room full of Met fans that are despondent, except for the lone Yankee fan, my roommate, who is barely awake on the couch, and he keeps with his arms folded, relaxed like he's in a summer chaise lounge. He's saying, "Relax, man. They're dogs. They always lose." And it's, you know, with two outs and nobody on, down by two runs. So I'm sitting there with my foam finger, you know, with my Mets shirt on, and I've been through hell. The whole playoffs have been hell. I mean, every game was hell with the Astros, you know. So I'm sitting there, and I'm watching Gary Carter, who was batting about .141 in the World Series that year. And he affectionately called the dog every time he got up. Oh, the dog's up. It's over, you know. And he gets a single, and the fans in the stands, now I talked to people that were at this game, they didn't really react that much. It was just, okay, we didn't make the last out.
Right.
Then the next guy gets a hit.
Right.
And then the next guy gets a hit. And then they bring in Stanley. Now, as a Red Sox fan, when this happens, for some reason, the game isn't tied yet. You still got two outs and a guy in third.
Right.
What's happening to the collective psyche of a Red Sox fan who's watching this game slip away when they see Bob Stanley, eco at large, lumbering in from the bullpen to get the last out? Do you have this, like, doom-gloom thing going on, or are you just feeling like we're going to get lucky here in the game, or what?
No, actually, Stanley was pretty good, so he wasn't the reason people were getting upset. It was just the one after another break going the Mets' way that brought that sense of uh-oh to our collective awareness, because we had no precedent for turning things around as we do now. And so the collective psyche reacts very differently now to a series of bad events to the way it did back then. But you know, I'd rather not dwell on 86 because I have like many millions of others, I have a chronic case of post-traumatic stress disorder every time I think about that.
Well, I mean, I'm also a Ranger fan, so I went through similar circumstances in numerous Stanley Cup playoff rounds, and when they finally won the Cup in 94, again, it was one of these, you know, almost like a birthing process. We're playing the Devils in the seventh game of the semifinals. They tie the game with 7.7 seconds left. I'll never forget this.
Wow.
And you know, we won nothing game. They tied the game. We're going to go to overtime in the seventh game. We're the Rangers. We haven't won the Cup in 54 years. I'm on the phone with my father, and he said he was going to shut all the TV off, all media off at all. He's going to sit in the darkness in his chair and to call him when the game was over. Right? Because he said, "I'm too old. I'll die in my living room if I watch this." Right? He goes, "You're young. You tell me what happened." So he said he was gonna sit in the dark, and he was just going to pray. Right? Now, this is an example of your non-local research. This is amazing.
Right.
So there I am. I had to call my roommate in Florida because I had to talk to somebody because I was out of my mind. And you get very superstitious when these things happen.
Exactly.
So I'm sitting. I'm not moving. I'm holding the cat on the floor where they don't move, you know. double overtime, right? Very dramatic ending with the Rangers score, and there's a famous call, Mateau, and the Rangers go on to the finals. And again, the whole thing repeated itself in the Stanley Cup finals, so they won seven games in that final, too. And you get very sort of almost like you kind of revert back to a child-like mentality of, you know, everything has to be just so, you can't move your feet, no one can move in the room. Where does all that stuff come from in terms of the way your research has pointed out the fan superstition and sort of that influence of if I move, then they're going to screw up on a game, miles away?
Well, I think that's a really good comparison that you make, because everybody does have that experience from childhood where you have these sort of magical beliefs that if you wear a certain shirt, lucky shirt or whatever, that it influences the effect on distant events. And part of growing up is learning that that's not possible. Actually, I'm a psychiatrist, and there's a certain subgroup of patients who develop delusions that their thoughts can affect other people and other events, and we treat that with medication. So there's a lot of precedent for disbelieving these kind of things, and that's why some of the research on prayer and other phenomena is so intriguing, because it actually shouldn't be true. So there's a couple of ways that this shows up. The prayer research is tricky because it involves people and it's not controlled. You can't. Some of the studies look at what influence on people's health or recovery from illness to have a designated group of people praying for them without knowing that they're being prayed for. And there's so many variables going on, it's really hard to control it. That's the same with Red Sox Nation or any sporting event. Obviously, there's more to, whether Carlton Fisk's home run was going to go fair or foul was more than just the wishes of everybody. It had to do with the aerodynamics of the ball and the wind speed and things like that. So it's at best, it's going to be, an additional influence. It's not going to be the sole factor. That's why experiments where you can control all the variables are so telling. And some of the research that's been done, especially out of Princeton, where they use computers. They influence computers with the mind rather than human behavior, because if you can show an effect on a machine where there's no bias or placebo effect or anything like that, then you know that you've got something really solid, and then you can generalize to people.
This is that pair research down there in Princeton.
That's
I've seen them presented many times in my travels in the somatic universe, where they looked at these things called random number generators.
That's right.
And your capacity to influence whether it goes, what is it, one or a zero, would just put your consciousness, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, it sounds kind of ridiculous, because it's basically using a computer to flip a coin, and that if you flip it 50 times or 100 times, it's going to split 50-50, more or less. To get big numbers and to magnify the effect, they do it by computer 1,000 times a second. It's done electronically, not with an actual coin. And what these guys have shown over the course of 30 years of research is that human intention can skew those numbers in a significant way. Their effects tend to be small, but reproducible over thousands and thousands of repetitions. So that was sort of the...
So how do they explain it? I mean, do they have any plausible way of explaining it?
Well, they're honest that it is very puzzling that our normal way of looking at reality can't account for these kind of events. So their current way of talking about it uses quantum mechanics to basically it's partly an explanation and partly a metaphor that at the quantum level, at the subatomic level, things are linked up or entangled. That's the word that kind of has a buzz to it these days. And they say that the same thing can happen. Action at a distance using with human consciousness as the quantum factor there. I have to admit that I don't really understand that research. It's a language that kind of looks more descriptive than explanatory.
Well, this is the stuff that's been, with what the bleep and the secret and everyone thinking that they're changing the red lights on the road with their heads and all that. It sort of crosses the line of create your own reality or co-create your own experience. It's kind of like what I'm trying to get at with this stuff, is that some of the aftermath of 9/11, they put these random number generators all over the planet, and they went back and looked, and right before the first plane hit the towers, there was a surge in all these things collectively around the world, as if on a other than conscious level, the planet was bracing for an event. You know, there's seismic
right.
events,
I mean, that,
and then there's
that,
the psychic
that
events.
Example, that example has two amazing aspects to it. You're describing the outgrowth of the Princeton research, where they took these random number generators and they put them in about 50 or 60 labs around the world and have them running continuously. And they're basically taking the pulse of the Earth or the brainwaves of the Earth because,
mm-hmm.
you know, normally it's 50-50, ones and zeros, but every once in a while there'll be big spikes and things become non-random, and those tend to correlate to important world events. And the biggest spike they got in the last, whatever it is, 6 or 8 years, was 9/11, which in itself is amazing because how does a computer anywhere know what's going on in New York? But the other weird thing is that, as you said, the spike happened before the first building was even hit. So
yeah,
I can't get my mind around that one because it does imply that somehow consciousness has some awareness of a physical event even before it happens. So that's
well,
a whole other show. I don't
Benjamin Lippitt's research out in the West Coast. I don't know if Dr. Jeb's still hanging around. He's still there, Jeb, or are you in
yeah.
Babyland?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Well, they talk about that half-second delay in consciousness. Like, if you just take your finger and just touch your arm, there's a half-second delay of the act and the register, you know, the conscious recognition of the experience by your brain, because that delay is basically the processing, sort of like, you know, in radio you have a seven-second delay, a dumb switch. Your brain has that half-second delay to say,
right.
is that new, or do I know what that is?
Right.
And so perception on a cosmic level or on a collective level around the planet,
right.
Who knows what the half-life is on that. Maybe it is, you know, 20 minutes, a half an hour, as the crow flies.
That's a good example, because it's basically saying the brain doesn't create consciousness. The brain reacts to
Downloading
it's happening at a subtler level. So that's
uh-huh.
one way of picking it up. The random number generators are another way of picking it up. And maybe, you know, our effect on the ball games is a third way. We took the Princeton people did some tests at the sporting events and weren't able to detect big fluctuations. They thought it might be because you've got competing intentions, you know, that fans from both teams are wishing for opposite effects, so it sort of cancels each other out. But we've been using a second generation version of this software, and we found some pretty significant moment-to-moment fluctuations, and one of the games that the Red Sox let us go to and make some recordings, there were some pretty amazing parallels between when the computer, you know, really fluctuated and what was going on in the game.
Yeah, you know, I took that you sent that email out with this sort of the crowd coherence before there were, you know, events in the game and how these things would sway and spike depending on the success or failure of the Red Sox.
Right.
And there's a statistical thing that's online that looks at these things. It's called fan graphs, and basically it charts the events, the same events of the game, but on a statistical level of what percentage it's going to influence the outcome of the game at any point in the game. And I did that game against the game that you guys did,
yeah.
and it's almost the mirror image of it in terms of the literal event and then the perceived event that the crowd was having. There's just a slight difference. The crowd was a little bit ahead of the actual things happening on the field. So I'll send you the link for this fan graphs thing.
Do, yeah. What are they actually measuring from the crowd? Is it the noise of the cheering?
No, they're not measuring anything. They're just taking the events in a baseball game and basically, you know, what percentage it's going to meet towards the outcome of it's almost like you're working from 50-50 who's going to win and say, you know, guy hit the three-run homer. Okay, now it goes to 75% chance this team's going to win. And then the other guy comes back and, you know, gets three runs the next inning, it's tied, it's back to 50. And so all these things, you know, when something happens in during the course of the game, you'll see a change in the, it's almost like a stochastic read or like a stock market read of high and low, of how the rhythm of the game is going. And, you know, when the Mets had that epic collapse in September, I was taking these charts, you know, and I was sitting here watching these games hooked up to my freeze framework, because I have the same system you guys have with the heart math stuff.
Okay, yeah.
And between innings, I'd watch my heart rate go down. Like, it was, the coherence was ridiculous. It was like all 100% noise, you know, because I was freaking out because the game wasn't over yet, but I was anticipating defeat. My brain was going into like defense physiology, and your breathing rhythm goes off. And all of these patterns that we talk about in our work of incoherence will interfere with your ability to adapt in the moment and basically handle adversity. So it's like survival keeps you alive, but in order to get to these higher levels, you have to have an evolved physiology, which doesn't take things as literally as that. And so that's why a clutch player like Big Poppy, as opposed to A-Rod, who we beat up on the show regularly, mercilessly, because this is the thing. Our system talks about a person's profile, which is their primary orientation, which is established during brain development. Both Big Poppy and A-Rod are the same. They're both philosomatic. They're both people-oriented human beings, so that they resonate from relationship. A-Rod, of course, in the low coherence friction level of, you know, he wants to be Jeter and he can't, and Big Poppy in that he carries a lot of the psyche of the team on his back and he thrives on it.
Well, that's true, and it was ironic that the Sox collapsed the year before. The trigger event was when David Ortiz had to miss a few games because he developed a heart arrhythmia. And
yes.
It seemed like he was bearing the stress of a team that didn't quite have what it took. And,
what happened to Manny? Manny took a flyer.
I think Manny's oblivious. I don't think these things get
well,
to his physiology
well, this
one
is,
way or the other.
So this actually ties in because Manny has a different orientation. He's on the somatic level, he resonates with the three-year-old brain, which is more of an eco-somatic awareness. He's an emotional guy, so his passion is going to be more like Pedro, where it's going to be if it's interesting, compelling, and sort of has a little drama to it, he'll tune in. But if it's mundane and ordinary and sort of the grind, he tunes out. So that's why when Big Poppy left, it's like he lost a lot of his ability to kind of buffer, and he just said, "Yeah, my knee hurts, I'm done,"
yeah.
And that was
yeah,
it. He tanks.
That's
so knowing their primary domain and knowing how they process, it gives you an idea. Like especially when you're dealing with pitcher and catcher and batter and crucial situations. Like Papelbon, perfect example. Remember early in the season last year, he gave up that home run to Jeter in the pouring rain there, and Fenway. I think it was top of the ninth inning, that spurred the Yankees on. That they were like almost basically out of it at that point. They came roaring back. Same guy, Papelbon, in the playoffs was unstoppable because during the course of the season he had to overcome that failure, and that as an onto, as he is, he's onto-somatic, he's always onto his own physiology. It's almost like punching a tiger in the nose, he's going to come back at you harder. So it actually, the failure made him concentrate. No different than someone that goes from crawling to walking, they fall a lot and they concentrate more and they become more accurate in the way they process. He's a speed demon, that guy, Papelbon. And that's why the more success he has early, usually he analogs out. So it's like looking at all those things, especially with the cardiac stuff, it's almost like you're getting a three-dimensional version of the event that you don't normally see by looking at the flat statistical stuff. So,
well, the ideal thing would be to have the heart monitors on all the players during the game and see what their heart rate variability is and whether they actually go into coherence together as a team or whether the fans go into coherence together as a fandom and kind of resonate the team to that higher level of coherence. That would be...
Well, there's certain arenas. Like, I've been to Wrigley Field. You know, I've been to some of these other stadiums. And you can tell that the boundary between the audience and the participants will wax and wane depending on basically, sometimes it's the lunar cycle during the month. Like, right now, we're just completing one that ends today, and then we're going to start the new cycle tomorrow. That will take you from more of an empathic rhythm to one that's going to be more suspicious. So it's like there's an overarching element there that will guide the limbic system in the brain to say which factor is more relevant right now. And then that's why players, when they go into slumps, you know, I always check, well, where are we in the lunar cycle? And I see what domain that particular player is. And I go, yeah, he's going to, you know, if someone is more like a Big Poppy and he's a philo, he's not going to do as well as we approach the full moon, because that's too frontal lobe for him. It's too much concentration. It's like a little kid with a bright light in his eyes. So he's going to come back 3 days later when it's more eco-somatic, it's more kinesthetic again. So these things are like, you know, that's kind of the stuff that we're doing with this on the somatic side, to see how does one person process this multivariate environment, and you're doing the stuff with the crowd stuff, so it's sort of simpatico here.
Oh, exactly, yeah. I mean, ideally, if you can get it on clicking on all cylinders at all levels working at the same time, then it wouldn't matter the phase of the moon or, you know, wouldn't
matter. Well, you can override it because you have that, like, this is
right.
Where we get into that
right.
Voluntary versus the volitional versus the involuntary stuff. So we got Dr. Jeb back here for a sec. You back on the phone there, Jeb?
For a minute, yeah.
Okay. I don't know if you dipped out before. We were comparing Big Poppy to A-Rod, you know, his two philos, and you being a card-carrying philo.
Yeah.
And you know, me and Professor Val, who's I think she's still there, Val.
Yeah,
she's not interested in any sports stuff. is that on a psychological level, because you guys are both psychologists, you and Professor Val, when you're dealing with personality, you know, introvert, extrovert, and all the traditional stuff, as opposed to these primary domains like I'm talking about, which is more kind of a bottom-up processing, like a body-to-brain processing, what do you guys think, as the psychologists I'm asking, what do you guys think is the bridge that allows a person to kind of overcome their personality traits and achieve in an environment that they normally would not thrive in? Like in Eli Manning, he can't play in cold weather, he can't do this, he's not his brother, and then he goes out and he beats up on Favre in an icebox. You know, how does that happen? On a psychological, what would be the psychological spin on that? Confronting a demon point. Or whatever. Yeah, go ahead. You go first, yeah. You're the guest.
Okay, well, I think anybody can, you know, personality is sort of basic constraints, but anybody can override it and achieve a higher potential. I think a lot of it has to do with the belief system and just being clear and focused. And it just took a while for Eli Manning, for example, for it all to gel. And, you know, for most players, it takes a couple of years to get the hang of it. But when you're at that level, anybody has the potential. And that's why on any given day, any given team, you know, can beat anybody. It's just a matter of how you sustain that on a regular basis, and that's what makes the truly greats. And of course, it's not an individual sport. You know, an individual sport would be somebody like Roger Federer, who has an amazingly consistent streak. But if you have a team to work with and you get into a sort of coherent state where the chemistry is ideal, then it sort of lifts people up when they're having an individual kind of slump. And then the final factor would be the fan input that can even, hypothetically, influence team chemistry, so you can have it working on three different levels at once that ultimately impacts the individual psyche of each individual player. That's one way of looking
at it. You know, just as you were talking about the different stadiums, Mark, it made me think about, like, back before 04, whenever it got late in the game, particularly at Yankee Stadium, it was like, oh, here come the ghosts, and, you know, you knew it was going to happen. It was like we talked Freddy Krueger, you know, you can't kill them. And they're always going to come back, particularly as a Red Sox fan. But there was something, and I was wanting to talk to Rick just in the sense of, do you look at the coherence factors and the fan influences? Because you have, like we said, we have competing things. So Yankee Stadium is predominantly a Yankee factor,
right?
But there's this whole Red Sox nation out there that's got this influence. And what I was thinking about in 03 and previous to that was
03.
When you look at the whole intention, you know, as soon as Pedro got left in there, everybody knew the game was over.
Yeah.
And when you have you know, a million people looking at going, okay, it's all over. What's the influence there? And then you have the whole Yankee fan base going, okay, here, this is our chance. We're back in it. But then you flip it. You go 04. What was the vibe? What a lot, you know, because it just felt like it felt different, because maybe they had been to the lowest point, or the lowest, most recent lowest point of 03.
Well, that's right. I think part of it, what they learned from 03 was that they could win. It was just a bad managerial decision that kept them from doing it, but they were basically there. And that made it much easier for them to stay with it, even when the odds looked impossible in 04. And that's why they literally went to the last strike. And, you know, we had a chance to interview Kevin Millar, who was the guy who drew the walk against Rivera that got the whole rally going. And that's what he said. They were just taking it one pitch at a time, and whatever happened in the past wasn't a negative that was dragging them down, because they knew there were possibilities. And that's sort of their way of talking about being in a meditative state, that they were just focusing totally on the present moment, and, you know, the past demons weren't a factor in their
Well, I want to take a little side street on this demon thing, because, Val, give us a little woo interpretation as a card-carrying woo that you are there. If you're dealing with the tarot with this, like if someone's dealing with you know, a tarot card or a death card, or, you know, you're facing Mariano Rivera, who is Enter Sandman, literally, right? And you're the Red Sox, and you're down 3-0, and you're basically, this is your last at bat. That existential element here comes in. we talked about personality before. When you're dealing with a psychic death, not a physical death, but a psychic death, a loss, what do you think what would be the psychological babble about, you know, how does someone somehow summon up the inner strength to face this thing finally and defeat it? Because the dragon keeps coming up, like we were just saying, you're going to have to deal with it. Like I knew when the Rangers won the Stanley Cup, it wasn't going to be some quiet four-game sweep. It was going to be, you know, bright lights, hearts in your head, everything, you know, basically having this sort of almost like a catharsis going on. So from a psychological standpoint, when someone's facing their inner demon in a public event like that, what's the psychological underpinnings? How do they overcome that obstacle at that point, depending on what they are personality-wise? What would be the woo explanation of that?
Well, if you're looking at, like, the tower card or the death card like you were talking about, the death card is just change. People don't deal with change very well. So I don't know how.
So you're changing a collective persona, like the Red Sox were the perennial losers. I mean, I don't know what would have happened if they had played the Cubs. Maybe if they were playing.
Yeah.
You know, then, I mean, talk about, look at that dopey fan, you know, with the Cubs that year. I mean, the guy had almost moved out. I think he had to move out of the suburb of Chicago because they were, threatening this guy's life. That poor fan. So it's like there seems to be somewhat of a fog or a sort of like a unseen shadow that kind of follows these perennially losing teams where the fans expect defeat when victory is right there. It can be right there, and they'll still just patiently wait for defeat to show up instead of having a proactive or sort of a seize the day kind of a mentality, where the Yankees never feel like they're out of a game. They feel entitled. Jeter gets up there with that smug look on his face, no matter what's going on.
Right.
And I just, the pinstripes do something to his heart? I don't understand it. It's
well,
very frustrating.
In a way, it's the power of suggestion. These guys, by their experience, have seen that they can turn anything around. I think that's true for everybody, but most people don't have the prior experience to back it up. But if you can convince yourself that it's true, then you begin to act that way, regardless of what the external situation is. So it's the power of intention that they talk about. For those last 86 years, for the Red Sox, it was the negative power of intention, or the power of negative intention. And then because of 03 and 04, we flipped it around and realized that, hey, we can do it too, and we're the new Yankees now. You know, we have the positive belief system just by virtue of putting on a Red Sox uniform.
Yeah, because it's funny because, you know, the Mets talk about their magic and all that stuff, and the Yankees have, awe and mystique. And somehow, what's his name with the bloody sock up there, even when he was pitching for the Diamondbacks, he said, all and mystique are just two strippers in a bar downtown in the Bronx. I don't listen to them.
Yeah.
And the good part about him, particularly Schilling, is that he's another one of these Onto sapiens that refers to his own physiology, doesn't reference the outside world at all, completely internalizes, it can shut off.
Mm-hmm.
And so none of this superstitious stuff affects him because it's not in his belief system. It's really not, it's like, you know, you're playing Battleship and that's a miss. It's never going to get him. So it's all about it's staying within himself is really where his game is played, just like Jeter. You can't rattle Jeter.
That's actually what, I don't know if you're familiar with Abraham Hicks, the people who talk about, they were the first ones to talk about the power of intention. Had a chance to ask them about the Red Sox at one of the workshops, and they tended more towards that approach that, group phenomena are nice, but it's not the crucial factor. The crucial factor is how each individual person lines up with their own intent. And the more you can be absorbed in your own inner process, the more likely success will be. So it was interesting to hear. It didn't quite fit in with the Red Sox Nation theory, but it was another take on things.
Yeah, well, this is one of the things, like, if you understand these primary domains and how they influence brain development, you can kind of see who's going to have more of a bias towards coming through in the clutch. It's like, it's so funny now because everyone talks about, the Giants have won, 10 straight games on the road going into the Super Bowl. So you'd think that at home they'd have the most support of all, right? But actually, Giant fans are very critical. So as soon as one thing goes wrong in the game, they would say, Eli's got rabbit ears, he hears the boos from the crowd,
and it's like
the whole thing just unfolds on him. So he goes on the road, he can delete all that information because it's not relevant to him.
Right.
And
he doesn't have the crowd noise or vibes to pull him back down, and he can sort of stay within his own sphere, within his own zone.
Yeah, and he's a task-oriented, you know, exo-sapien. He basically is going on his occipital lobe just on images. He's not going on internal processing. So it's almost like he's in, like, a soundproof room. So when he can just, the crowd noise isn't there to rattle him, it's almost like he could function at a higher level. When he's home, he's going back into that philo kind of bonding mode, and it's like he feels somewhat obligated to perform. And if you get a self-conscious, somatic kind of reference, what happens is that it's almost like you're walking on a tightrope and you feel more inhibited. So the more he has to think and be deliberate and be more frontal lobe, he starts to collapse. And that's why, you know, this whole thing, he can't play at home as well as he can on the road. And it's bared out.
So
the season,
are New Yorkers worried about Sunday, or are they pretty, you guys pretty optimistic?
Well, you know, what's funny is that the more the game has shifted from, you know, the aftermath of the Green Bay game, which they practically would have thrown a victory parade and just bypassed the Super Bowl completely.
Right.
To now, this sort of like we're going through the conveyor belt. It's almost like on a daily basis there's some other leak. And Plexico Burress, the Giants receiver, who is an eco, he's an emotional nutball, is basically acting the way players from other teams like the Cowboys are acting before their game, and he's predicting the score, and he's guaranteeing victory, and he's completely out of his mind because he had the game of his life against the Packers.
Yeah, he did.
You know, so typical eco, he's gone past the point. He's like he's past the guardrail. He's on the dirt road. He's in the trees. Hopefully they'll rein him in by the next couple of days, because we do get out of that lunar phase. I think it ends. Let's see, today. Yeah, it ends today. So tomorrow, perfect. This is actually, I just looked down, I just got happy, because tomorrow, the 31st, starts the exo phase of the lunar cycle, so that goes through
February.
Through February 6th, yeah.
Yeah.
So this is actually eco's, it's going to help an eco ground themselves, because you become more suspicious, you become more left-brain-oriented, more logical, less of the emotional stuff, and it's also going to help Eli, because he's an exo, so he's going to have a little lunar support going into the weekend, and our buddy, Mr. Brady, Mr. Philo, will feel a little cold, a little left out, a little distant from his teammates because of the waves changing. So watch the Super Bowl hype change from now until the weekend, especially relevant to the more emotional types on both teams. You're going to see a little more fragmenting on the Patriots side, especially those Philo guys that are more kind of, you know, almost lockstep behind Belichick. And the Giants are going to be kind of more kind of like, just like they went into Dallas and Green Bay, more kind of like a little army of ants coming in, you know, just with their helmets on, and you're not going to see their faces as much. So it'll be interesting to see how they take on Eli's persona going into the game. But there's so much going on. We got a Mercury retrograde to talk about. There's all kinds of cosmic stuff going on. But it's funny, because your stuff would seem unconventional to the mainstream psychologist, the mainstream. Physician that's looking at consciousness and things like this, the people that are studying this stuff in universities, our stuff would seem weird to you guys. So it's like, you know, we're just one standard deviation away from normal from, you know, as far as the way these things look at. So
that's right.
We're kind of, we got a little more of a funkified little map of this. So, but, you know, if anybody wants to call in with their Super Bowl prediction and kind of get on the air with Rick, it's 646-478-4847. 9:44. We got a couple minutes left. So, where does this stuff go now that we know all these phenomena are out there, and we know that?
I'd like to go
back and forth going. What do we do with all the information?
Well, what I'd like to do is compare different fandoms and get a sense in different games which emotions are being picked up, whether certain types of cheering have more of an impact, whether it's possible to get crowds into coherence better. I mean, one of the things we found was that in the two games that we've measured and monitored closely, the one moment of highest group coherence happened during a Red Sox game when they play this a sort of a theme song. It's a rally song they play in the eighth inning of every game called Sweet Caroline.
Mm-hmm.
So it was during a group sing-along that brought the highest level of coherence. So
sure.
Maybe there's ways that teams can take advantage of that. So that's one factor we'd like to measure. And viewers who want to check out that graph, they can go to the website. It's www.thejoyofsoxmovie.com. And then
when's the movie coming out, by the way?
What's that?
When's the movie coming out?
Well, let me just finish the website.
Yeah,
slash blog, and then it's you scroll down about four listings ago, and there's a graph that shows how the events correlate with the graphing. We're in the post-production phase now, so we're hoping to finish in time for the World Series this time around. But we could do with some funding. So if there are any philanthropists out there who want to support some crackpot science, this is a great opportunity to do it. And
yeah,
the other thing we'd like to measure is whether any of these ballparks are actually sacred spaces. So when there's nobody there, is there still a certain vibe that's been kind of embedded or imbued in the setting? And our plan was to do these kind of measurements at Fenway Park in the off season now, but unfortunately they're doing a lot of renovations. So, you know, the team gave us permission to come and make measurements, but they said, you know, there's construction crews going on, so it's not like we're going to be in some isolated shrine and just getting the vibe of the place. So I'm not sure what that would show, but, you know, to measure Fenway's vibe and compare it to Yankee Stadium when nobody's there. What's the difference? Is there some kind of has it become a conditioned space in the way that William Tiller, the physicist from Stanford, has been able to demonstrate?
Yeah, you're getting into the Sheldrake area here with the morphogenic fields and stuff.
So
what happens, like, when they tear down the stadiums, like the Mets are going to be in Citi Field in 2009, Yankees are moving across the street. When you tear down the physical stadium, does the energy of that just stay in that physical location? If there's anyone that ever, you know, I've had people just, you know, use these iconoclastic events, things like that, like name the top five events in your life, and it's like, you know, I'll just go right through the chakras or something like that and just touch a point, and you'll see a heart, you know, the heart jump into coherence. It's an anchor that they've internalized. So I wonder if the physical location has that sort of property too, where someone can just, you know, basically, you know, Google map it or go there physically and get some resonance from it, because like you said, there's a certain encoding that goes on and over time, and you know, the Indians did it, the feng shui and other cultures have it. Why can't we have it with ballparks? I don't think it's
That's a good question. I'll do the measurements at Fenway, you do the measurements at Yankee Stadium, and we'll compare and see what we find out.
No, what do you guys measure? What do you guys use to measure that stuff? I mean,
it's just a laptop. I just bring a laptop. It has a program that's developed by a group called ComSire, ComSCIRE, and it's like a second generation of the Princeton random number stuff.
Okay.
And they also have a small external peripheral, so you get two different data streams, and the final analysis is when the two data streams are correlated. Those are the moments of true accuracy. And I generate the data and then send it off to the guy out in Boulder, Scott Wilbur, who's been coordinating all this. And he prints out the graph of coherence without knowing what happened during the ball game.
Sure.
So he sends the graph back to me saying, here are the five moments of peak coherence. And I go through my list of the notes I took during the game of when I thought the crowd was most into it and see when they correlate. And the one piece that we analyzed on that blog site that I mentioned, there were seven moments of high coherence, and six of them happened during key events during the game. And he said, Scott estimated that the odds against that are like 100 million to one. So it's like really phenomenal.
And the seventh one was when they were singing the song.
Pardon me?
And
that was when
they
were singing the song, right, was the highest moment of all. So.
Yeah, Boulder, Colorado, huh? I wonder why. So actually, you know what? There's a conference that I'm going to be attending over here in Wesleyan University in February, not only a dynamics conference that deals with subjects like this and coherence. You can come down.
What's the name
of
the conference?
It's called the Winter Chaos Conference. It's a bunch of guys that are basically, you know, professors, researchers, practitioners like myself that we kind of hang out for 3 or 4 days over and we're going to be in Wesleyan University in just south of Hartford.
Wow.
So if you want to shoot down for a day and just kind of hang out and share your research, because it's really kind of a small circle of about 50 guys that meet once a year and kind of share their research and get their ideas and get together, your stuff would be, you'd be all over the hallways. You'd have a lot of friends there. And those guys are connected to, you know, people that do the, you know, the pair things and the bigger stuff. So you might want to shoot down and join us there.
If you can get me some info on that, a link or something, I'd be glad to connect.
Yeah, I'll get you hooked up, and you might be able to get on the ride board and, you know, and hang out with us, because it's one of those things, like I said, this is stuff that's so rare and so It's like when I met Roland McCready in the 90s out there in another place, Boulder Creek, California. What a
right.
mountain ride that was. Ears and eyes popping out of my head up the mountain. And you know, and Bruce Lipton drove me back down the mountain a couple of days, and I met Joseph Chilton Pierce when I was up there. I was like, what am I doing with these people? And so that got me started on this idea that, and from chiropractic, we deal a lot with interference and stuff. It's like, wait a minute, maybe this is all socially shared and entrained, and we just get used to living sort of out of balance with our surroundings. And if we become more aware how to resonate, we overcome a lot of these things, and the whole species benefits.
Well, I think that's the vision for the future, and that's why places like Institute of Noetic Science are really on the leading edge of this whole new wave. I've talked to Roland and HeartMath people about doing some research of group coherence, and you know, the theory would be if you got 10 people, let's say, who are doing that heart meditation, they've got their heart rhythms into coherence, and an 11th person joins the group without meditating, does his heart get entrained into that resonant pattern? That would be a really cool thing to test out and measure. So,
yeah, I mean, Rifkind is the guy
that
the guys that's in that group, his name is Rifkind. He's a Russian dude that looked at, tank teams in the Army that they would share, the coherence in a tank. You know, basically, there's the frequency pulling of the four hearts in a unit that's doing the same task. And the data you're talking about can be broken down using some nonlinear analysis to see when there's stochastic breaks and when there's actually like a resonance, almost a noise-induced order that comes over the system as a self-organized a data set that can actually take someone who's out of sync and pull them into sync, almost like a beehive, you know, that these guys that are going to be gathering in Connecticut can explain to you. So, there's a lot of overlap here. So,
very nice.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for joining us. So, I assume you're a Pats fan going into the weekend, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So what are you guys more? I guess this is as a closing argument. This might be. I mean, Jeb, are you rooting for the Pats this weekend? I mean, you got to be, right?
You got me on there. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm rooting for the Pats, definitely.
Okay. So just tell me, you two Pat fans, because you're about to be splatted against the wall of somatic the goo here. If you read Block Summer this week, I gave my complete analysis of the coach and quarterback relationships. Anyway, what are you guys feeling as far, because you've been through this ride before with the Super Bowls, are you feeling more the pressure to be the undefeated team and 19-0? Because there's already a book on Amazon called 19-0, by the way. Talk about being overly ahead of the curve, Boston Globe. So is it more about, would you feel more of a loss, if not just losing the Super Bowl, but just becoming the only undefeated team, to lose a Super Bowl kind of a thing. Is it more about the undefeated stuff and the perfect season stuff, or is it more about just not winning the Super Bowl?
I would say for me, it's probably more keeping the 19-0 stretch.
Because that's all they talk about. They talk about history and they talk about immortality. They talk about Brady's talking about this as something that's going to be remembered 100 years from now. It's almost like they're making it a bigger deal than it is. And then the same voice, almost, they're going, just another game, because they got the Belichick speak in their head that sort of takes all the emotion out of it. So I just wonder what, as the Patriots approach this, they're playing a team that they're never going to get they can go through a million different combinations. You're never going to get to a Super Bowl being undefeated and a two-touchdown favorite. Yeah, you're never going to have more of an advantage going into a game than you could possibly have. I just wonder if the fan base up there and it's funny because the Patriots don't have the best, legacy, the best history in the world, as far as the whole history, but the last 10 years, of course, they have. You guys have got a lot of scar tissue with the Red Sox and some other teams. Do you guys feel sort of like maybe a Yankee fan would feel going into a World Series? Do you just expect to win at this point?
I think that's where it's at, yeah, that we see this team is so resilient, and especially Brady has engineered so many comebacks that I don't think too many people are worried. The only caveat would be if Brady goes out that day with an ankle brace, then there might be some cause to worry. But basically, we know how to do it. We've seen all different situations, and I don't think they're thinking about 19-0. I think they know how to focus on one game at a time and one play at a time, and that's why they're so good.
All right, so what's your final score prediction to wrap this up there tonight?
Well, it depends on the ankle. I think I haven't gone into my crystal ball zone yet.
You picking a blowout or are you picking a close game?
No, I think it'll be close, but,
All right.
you know, maybe.
So Pats win, but don't cover. So bet the Giants and make some money.
Yeah,
with,
probably 7 to 10 points. Something like that.
All right. And Jeb, you're picking similar close game, but Patriots
yeah,
win again.
Yeah, I'm thinking less than seven. I think it's 24-30 or 24-27, something like that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you're all wrong.
I wouldn't say nervous, but I don't ever like to be in a situation where everybody's so certain that I always think back of the Broncos and the Packers. Everybody was dead certain. There was absolutely no way the Broncos could compete with the Packers. And, they went out there and ran. Like Terrell Davis just ran him over all
right.
day,
Right.
So I'm always kind of in sitting back saying, we're not going to gloat, don't know 19-0 books until you got 19-0 in the book.
Yeah, that's a little premature.
Well, I think it's hilarious. But you're ripping Plexico. You guys got a book out. So anyway.
Yeah.
All right, well, Rick, thanks for joining us. I'll get you that information about the conference. And I think, like I said, we've got, at least one hand on the same elephant here. So hopefully we can get a dialogue going and,
Very good.
You back on the show with some more research, towards, World Series time and when the movie's coming out. And everyone that missed the little announcement before, it's the joyofsoxmovie.com is the website, and there's a blog attached to it with all this is data and things like that. So, get up there, get on, and if anyone's out there listening that wants to throw them some money to get this thing in the theaters, I think it's great. The clips I've seen are great. And, just thanks for joining us here tonight on Super Bowl week, and we'll talk to you soon.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks, Rick.
See ya.
Thank you. Okay, you're all welcome.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Right.
Bye.
There we go.
In our typical fashion, we have a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So you got a tip of the week you can spit out here? We haven't even played any sounds. I'll just give you one of these just to... There you go. So you got about 45 seconds for your tip of the week there, Jeb. Go ahead.
All right,
hang on. My tip of the week.
That was your tip, Ugg?
No, I said lemon water.
Oh, lemon water. Oh, okay.
I'm drinking it right now as we speak.
Yeah, it's just it's like the end of the meal, and you want that you want that Haagen-Dazs, you want that something that top off the end of the meal, and you go, I'll have a cup of hot water with lemon, and then if I still want the Haagen-Dazs, I'll have a bite. And 9 times out of 10, you have the lemon water, and the craving's cut, and you feel really. It's not a thing about you can't have the sweet. It's just that do the lemon water. It's a nice way to finish the meal. Good way to start the morning too. So that's the tip of the week.
All right. And to wrap up our show tonight, a little quote for the road from Professor Val.
All right. This quote is from Howard Cosell. All right. Sports is human life in microcosm.
You heard it here first. Right there.
There you go.
All right. So I don't know who's on the show next week, but I know who's going to be appearing at halftime. My man at the Super Bowl, who will be doing the chicken dance if one of the
That's
players
right.
don't on the field.
Mm-hmm.
So I will send you out with this, everyone. Travel out through the darkness. Remember, it is the kicker in all of us that gets from A to B. Travel light. Go, Eli.
Not believing all I see to be so. I'm flying over backyards. Country homes and ranches, watching life between the branches below. And it's hard to say who you are these days, but you run on anyway, don't you, baby? You keep running for another place. Find that saving grace.
Don't hold
every door.